Welcome to the Beyond Body podcast with your hosts, Mia and Holly. Join us for a sometimes fortnightly podcast
where we explore all things mental health, being a messy human, and how to get the most out of this one precious life.
And all the ridiculous stories in between. Welcome back, everyone. I am so excited to let you know that we have Carolyn Costum returning to the podcast for the fourth time. Carolyn is one of my favorite people. She's one of my favorite people to speak to, and she has been so generous over the years in then extending that to our community and coming and sharing her wisdom and insights. And today was no exception. In fact, it was fantastic because we did something slightly different. I had jumped over on Instagram previously to ask you for the questions that you have for Carolyn. And Carolyn is a giant in this field. She's an expert. She's answered so many questions, been interviewed so many times, and you came up with stuff that she had never answered or addressed before. We go all over how Carolyn has navigated dark and difficult times, what her biggest lessons were from recovery, the regulation of the coaching field and where that's going, and her views on that. We went everywhere. So if you've heard Carolyn interviewed, which I'm sure you have, know that this is a really different perspective and a different chat. And I hope that you will enjoy it and get so much out of it. Again, huge thanks to Carolyn for any amount of time that you so generously give to us. And I'm sure that we will see you soon. We did say at one point, Carolyn said, I think that we should start a radio show. And I was like, yes, both of our schedules are quite full, but I would absolutely make a crater of room for something like that. But anyway, I hope you enjoy the chat and we will be back with an episode in a couple of weeks. Carolyn, thank you so much for being back with us today. I think this is our fourth podcast video together. I am always so honored and grateful to spend time with you, and I know that my audience feels the same way. So thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm very happy to be here. As you know, I like talking about this work and helping people and talking to you. So
always. This time we thought we'd do something a bit different. I went to Instagram and asked my followers to send us some questions and, you know, to say that Carolyn's coming to chat to us. What would you like to ask her? And they came up with some really interesting stuff, things that I've not been asked before. I sent them across to you. You hadn't been asked these kinds of questions before, so I'm really keen to get into them. Let's dive in with the first one, which I think a lot of people could relate to. How do you make yourself ready to recover?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question, because I would say for the most part, it's important to not wait until you feel like you're fully ready or I'm ready, because I think there's always going to be a little bit of mixed. There's going to be fear with being ready. There's going to be ambivalence with being ready. And so if you're waiting to be ready, I think you could be waiting for a long time. And but having said that, I think there are things you can do, like find somebody, someone on your team that you feel like you can trust and tell everything to, because that starts to be a game changer. Because I think too much of the time people think they're ready or they think they want to get better, but they can't share themselves. They can't really tell what's going on. Mm. So I would say if there was one thing that I looked for in somebody who was coming to see me, it would be building that relationship that they could eventually tell me everything they needed to tell me.
Yeah, that's so true. I think it's that, I've referred to it before as sort of like recovery literacy. Like sometimes you do need that period where you're even just getting used to using some of this new language and even accepting that this is something that you need to deal with. But I completely agree with you. I get asked, you know, how can I make myself ready? How can I make it easier? And, or when will it be easier and when will I be ready? And my response is always, you've kind of got to like make your luck with this process a little bit. You've got to create it for yourself. You have to make the next bit easier. You have to make the next bit a little bit more approachable. You can't sit around and wait for that light bulb to go off. It might happen on the rare occasion. It might be something that some people experience, but in my experience, I haven't seen a lot of just overnight shift, change, huge motivation without the fear and the anxiety.
And it waxes and wanes.
Yeah.
You might feel ready 1 week and then the next week you don't. So you can't, readiness is not a good term to use. It's like, I mean, for me, the reason I really started trying to get better is because I didn't feel like I was ready. Ready for what? I didn't even know the word recovered. I didn't even know there were people that could help me, but I thought, I just don't want to stay where I am. So yeah. Any movement, you know?
Yeah, it's you and I have talked about this when we did our chat for your Instagram, which is that, you know, it's very often that you're just tired and bored of Groundhog Day. If it's just that, if it's just the repetition and the boredom and the I can't just keep looking at this same day over and over again, that can be enough. But the idea that you're going to go from total fear and anxiety or ambivalence to 100% motivation, that's going to push you all the way through, is really just incredibly unrealistic. And then I think that people are saying, well, because that's not happening, I won't start, which is my big fear, that, you know, that's just stopping people from even like dipping their toe in the process.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. What is a quote or mantra which has helped you during difficult or dark times?
The one that comes to mind that I learned early on for myself was, I realized I could not be the judge of my own body.
Yeah.
When I, and that's not really a mantra, but it's something I learned to say to myself, because I was trying to get better and I'm the only one who saw myself the way I did. Mm. I'm the only one.
Mm.
And I just had to tell myself over and over, you can't be the judge of it. You're going to have to suspend that. You cannot be the judge of it. And that helped. I do have quotes that I put every treatment center I had some kind of quote on the wall. And the very first one, my baby, my very first Montanito, it was a quote from The Little Prince.
Aww.
That you might know. It was, it's only with the heart that one sees rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye.
Oh, beautiful.
Love that quote. And that's the same kind of, you know, what are you looking to see? And yes. It's, if you see with the heart, you see differently. And that helped me a lot with all the body image stuff, but with connecting with people on a soul level too. So
yeah, that was something I really loved when I was first exploring the keys. And obviously that was all expanded on in the coaching certification, was some of the perspective shifts that you do, which I think are so powerful, where we have so many societal lenses that we look at bodies through, food through. I remember you talking about even like buying a tomato plant. And that really struck me, that, you know, to watch something and tend to something and to see it change on a daily basis and go through these little incarnations, and for you to be in sort of collaboration with this thing that is bearing food and is this nourishing, wonderful thing that has been so scary, and taking away all those like labels that diet culture applies, or healthy or unhealthy, good, bad, and to just take it down to its rawest form and look at it through that lens, whether it is the body or food. Sometimes those perspective shifts can just be so powerful to get back down to being kind of in commune with these things that we're made to feel really distant from, or really disconnected from, in a way.
Are disconnected. I mean, the food that grown by somebody else and sent in tubs to the grocery store, you know, they do these things where they go in and, you know, talk to kids and they say, what is this? Where does it come from? And kids are like, have no idea.
Yeah.
We're disconnected. So it's like it's the alchemy of food. Yeah. And it's the soul level of food. It food becomes us. It actually becomes us. Mm-hmm. So it is so interesting to me. And I think we just don't have mentoring for that. So that's what I try to do, in a way, is have mentoring for having a whole different relationship with food in our bodies.
Yeah, that's what I've loved about the retreats, which we're doing one next week. I mean, I'm certainly not any amazing cook. I'm so grateful for Holly for so many reasons. She's a phenomenal coach, but she's particularly a phenomenal cook. And to get them into cooking classes and have them laughing and dancing and creating and making mistakes and, you know, creating memories. And it's just such a, obviously there's so much we can do as coaches one-to-one with cooking and shopping and going out for meals and snack support and all that kind of thing, but to actually be with people day after day and watching how they can see food differently and interact with it differently as a group and in community is something I didn't think I'd get to experience. And it's really powerful. And I can imagine that as part of Montanito, that was probably like a huge factor of what the transformation that you would see.
Well, it was so new because I ran hospital programs before that, and people would go down to the cafeteria with their little metal tray.
Yeah.
Right. And the workers at the hospital program would sit with tablets taking notes. And I'm like, oh, no, you have to eat with them.
Yeah.
And anyway, yeah. So opening Montanito, where we grew food and we actually, people got to go in the kitchen. And the same thing I'm trying to do at Wanda Narita now, you know, bring that philosophy to the first residential in Australia, where people can have fun and have music on and read angel cards and laugh at the table. It's a game changer, I think.
Yeah. I mean, well, if that's what we want their relationship to be like when they go home with food, then where does that start? Where are we going to kick that off?
Yeah, right.
We should probably be modeling it in the place where we're modeling it. I really like this one. What is one thing I can do as a daily habit to strengthen my healthy self?
Definitely journaling.
Yeah.
Definitely journaling back to those eating disorder thoughts. Mm. Because if you have an eating disorder, you have eating disorder self thoughts. Mm. And whether it's, oh, it's already a bit late, I can easily skip breakfast, or whether it's I have to go on a run if I eat that dessert, or whether it's I have to whatever it is, just taking a couple minutes, it doesn't take long, to come back with something that you would say if your best friend said that, if your niece said that. If you can't start saying it to yourself, think what you would say to somebody else, because everybody I've worked with has a healthy self in there.
Yeah.
It's in, it just comes out for other people, but it doesn't come out for you. And people think, what happens is, and this is really important, because what people will think is they'll hear it in their mind, what they're going to say, and they go, yeah, but I don't believe it or whatever. And what's really important, I do think writing changes it. I don't think, because people will stop themselves if they just go, oh yeah, I think that, but then write it out. That reinforces, it creates that neural pathway where you hear that healthy self pull on through the sentence. And don't make a bunch of BS, make something you do believe in. Mm. You would believe it if you said to your friend, I don't want you to say some BS to your friend. I want you to say something you believe.
Yeah. You know? And I think you're so right when you're just trying to do it in your head initially, because I explain the dialoguing process to people is like, first, you're going to be writing them out and they're going to be long and you're going to be doing a lot of them. And then they're not going to be as long because they all come back to the same three or four themes or fears. So the more you do them now, the better off you'll be long term. They won't be as long. You won't have to have them as frequently. Then you will be able to have them in your head. But your eating disorder has had so much longer to like build up its strength, that to get your healthy self back engaged and then have it just going back and forth in your head, it's at a disadvantage. It hasn't had the chance to strengthen itself. So writing it down and slowing down that interaction by making yourself write it down gives your healthy self a second, I think, to like get its breath and really consider what eating disorder self is saying and get a moment to get out what it needs to say. And I love, especially in the training, thinking back to how much it was stressed, like if people get stuck or lost, or they get stuck in, you know, when eating disorder just starts to spiral, especially when it starts to talk about minutiae, it starts to talk about little rules and that kind of stuff, and people get stuck in just the detail. How you always said, go back to what would you say to somebody else? Because I don't know, clients seem to follow trends sometimes. I've had a few people over the last couple of weeks reach out and be like, Mia, I'm completely stumped. I don't know what to say back. I don't know what to do here. I have no clarity. I'm not saying anything I believe. Every single time it is, this is the default. Always go back to this. I promise you, you will be able to come up with something, and that it's not a magic solution that because you say it to somebody else, you suddenly believe it, but it certainly does identify there's a gap here in your belief systems and in how you think. And then what is the gap and how can we start to close it?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
It works.
Yeah. And it's the specificity of the journaling, which is, you know, so much of what the keys is, you know, when you say to people, just go and journal. Like I used to be very averse to journaling. It was too nebulous. It was too broad. It was too vague. I was like, I'm not a Dear Diary person. But if you give me an activity like that, which we then, that's what I love about the practicality of how you break down recovery. And then the coaching role is certainly that practical application, is that we can give people a framework. Something that does feel mysterious and big is like, no, with these specific things, all these terms that you hear, like neural rewiring, et cetera, it all sounds very like sexy and sci-fi. It isn't. It's very boring and repetitive, but it works.
It's practical. It's practical. Yeah, I've been trying to talk to the coaches a lot about when they say to someone, do you like journaling? I said, don't ask that. This isn't even called journaling. This is a very specific task you need to do. Mm-hmm. Forget journaling. I mean, that leaves people, when people journal, just when they say, oh, go get a journal out, you can be lost and trapped in your negative thoughts, you know?
Completely.
It has to be specific and targeted.
What is the biggest lesson that recovery taught you?
Oh, that I could do something. Ugh, this is really interesting.
Yeah.
That I could do something that I would have sworn to you I couldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
I told my family I couldn't do it. I told myself, my friends, my doctors, there's no way. There's no way I'm going to gain that weight. There's no way I'm ever going to accept my body at that weight. There's no way I'm going to eat that food. And I believed it. Mm-hmm. How you can be so adamant about something and have such a strong belief that something is not going to happen and be so wrong.
Yeah. 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 I will say to people often that, you know, it's a great blueprint for the concept that like anything worth having in life is hard. Anything worth doing in life is hard. And it's usually you've got to take the action first before you feel comfortable with it or you feel like you can do it. And no one's taught how to do that. Nobody teaches you, oh, if you want this thing, you've got to be terrified for quite a while before you start to get the payoff of any of it. You've got to put out all the hard work before you start to get any return. And we're pushed into a corner and forced to do it in a way because obviously it's about survival, but gosh, it's a blueprint for business, relationships, anything that you want to achieve or have requires like that initial investment of like, I don't even know what's going to happen to me, but I've just got to do it.
Yeah, I'm always surprised at how people can be so adamant and about things like that and how I was. And if I could go back and meet that prior self, we would have such a good laugh about all the things that she said was not going to happen. And here, not only have I done it, but I'm helping other people do it all the time. It's just really wild. And I think it's important because everybody, I can't say everybody, but a huge 95% or more of people with eating disorders say things like, well, other people can do it, but not me,
yeah.
You know, or I just don't see myself being able to do it, or, you know, those kinds of things. And I say, we all said that.
Yeah.
That's not, you don't own that.
Yeah. That's a prerequisite.
Yeah.
This isn't on the list, but what do you think that Carolyn, right at the start of recovery, would think of all you've done and all you've achieved and where you are now?
Shocker.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, how did something that, you know, almost killed me became my life's work, right? Who would have thought? But I never thought I was going to be an eating disorder therapist. It's just that when I became a therapist, I was going to treat adolescents because I was a teacher and a therapist, and I thought I'd do therapy for adolescents. And then I got this girl referred to me, and it was really like uncanny. It was what happened in that session. And I asked her questions nobody had ever asked her because of my own lived experience. Mm. And it just was like, what? And then another one trickled in and another one, and I just never looked back. But I'd be shocked. I think my parents would be kind of shocked, although they both knew I had become an eating disorder therapist, but
yeah,
both of them have passed and they never saw Montanito or the coaching thing or all that. They would be like an empire.
Yeah.
Over this adversity, you know,
and all over the world.
Who knew?
Just incredible. It's so, yeah, I love thinking about those past versions of ourselves because they're all in there, you know, they're all in there being like, you know, where are we now? And it's like, we're okay, kid. We got there and we did some stuff with it.
I would have said, you're going to be on this podcast and people from are going to be listening to you. You're going to stand up as a keynote speaker at a conference. I would have said to myself, get out of here. And that's why I think we have to expect surprises. Mm. Yeah. Don't wait to think that you know, or don't wait to get things sorted before you move forward. Just know that you don't want to be where you're at and just move.
I completely agree, because when people are like, where are you going to be in 5 or 10 years? I like having direction, but I don't like the rigidity of, you know, where I'm going to be, because I find it so much more limiting than I do inspiring, because it means that you've got blinders on. You can't really see the opportunities that might be there, because you're only looking for the ones that you've already told yourself align with where you're going to be in 5 years.
Who knows what's coming?
Yeah. Yeah. Let life surprise you, and let yourself surprise you too. How would you change the current treatment landscape? How long have you got?
Okay, well, most people who are, you know, following anything I'm doing nowadays know that I'm really trying to change it with coaching, because we've been too long in the field without coaching, and particularly people with lived experience in coaching, getting the right kind of training and supervision and all of that to help others, because it is huge. I'm amazed by it. Even though I knew it was going to be a good thing, I'm amazed by it. But other than that, I think what really has to happen is we need to go back to looking at people as individuals. Everybody's in their camps, the CBT or FBT or, you know, IPT or ACT. I could probably go on with the camps. And do you weigh people with their back to the scale, or do you force everybody to look at their weight? And the rigidity in the camps has become almost untenable. Mm. Not having appropriate, respectful disagreements and dialogue. And I think we got to go back to wait. We can have all of our plans and all of our evidence-based treatments, but we got to look at the person in front of us at the moment. What is working for this person at this particular time? So I think we have to stop thinking we can rely on some protocol and just apply it to people. And that's what I see happening that has made me pretty disappointed in the field. I know people are trying to make sure, and the evidence-based treatments have some evidence. The evidence-based treatments, there's reasons for that, because before that, people were doing all kinds of, you know, who knows things. And because both, if you look at it, the two really evidence-based are CBT and FBT. And those two, you know what they do? They focus on the how. And that's what coaching doesn't spend a lot of time. Yes, I know your boyfriend broke up with you, but how is binging and purging on your food going to make that any better? It's not. Mm. How are we going to change that? It's not getting mired up in the underlying issues. And I think that's why they are as successful as they are, CBT and FBT. But I think we have to look at they're being overvalued and overpromoted. So that'll probably get me in trouble.
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's so true. I think that it's putting model before person. It's putting approach before person, and saying, I hear from people all the time where they've been told, but that by professionals, that they're not believed, because they say body image isn't a factor of my eating disorder, or, you know, this or this that falls into that diagnosis or non-diagnosis or whatever. I don't relate to that. And then we're still cramming them through a process that is invalidating or potentially re-traumatizing or whatever it might be. And it's like, okay, well, here's the mold. And if you don't fit through it, then we can't help you. And it's like, well, this is the beauty of having all these approaches. And I totally agree with you. I think it's where, you know, I've said before that, yes, of course, we need to put our time and attention and funding towards people who are in a position where they need to go to residential, where they need to be in an environment like that. But let's keep people out of those spaces by providing individualized care with outpatient approaches, which not only get in the door before somebody ends up in that kind of environment, but also treats them as an individual and says both, you know, yes, let's deal with the behavioral stuff. But it seems sometimes like, yeah, if we tick off symptom reduction or we tick off getting rid of the symptoms, then we fix this person. And it's like, they're still walking around with a wound that makes them so vulnerable. There's so many different things that have to be happening at once. And one approach is not going to be able to deal with all those comorbidities or contributors or whatever it is. And so the outpatient model has so much potential to be like, you come to us and we figure out what your particular mosaic of issues are, and let's address all of those individually versus just like shoving you through a cookie cutter program that may have absolutely no relevance to your situation.
I mean, one of the things I said in my recent talk is that people need more than just have their symptoms managed. They need to be, we need to inspire them to recover rather than require them to recover. Because what's happening when you're outside and trying to deal with it and not in a treatment program, the eating disorder voice is so loud and you're following eating disorder rules. And then when you go to a treatment program, if they just impose treatment rules, and that's the majority of the treatment effect you get, is the manage and supervision of the symptoms and all of that. Mm-hmm. Now you're following treatment rules.
Oh.
What is that?
Why? Oh my God. It's celebrating you.
I think it's very happy about what I said.
It's thrilled. Love that. Well, we'll know if people are watching because they'll let us know what's with the fireworks.
And then you leave treatment and you go back to eating disorder rules.
Yeah.
Unless there's been an internal shift.
Yeah.
And that's on an individual basis. That what is the internal shift that's going to happen for somebody? And so I think every clinician needs to really think about that. How are they helping that person shift? And the internal shift that I think is the biggest one is when you realize it's not my eating disorder made me do it. Mm-hmm. I made me do it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a part of me in there that I'll call the eating disorder self rather than externalize it and call it Ed or whatever else people call it. Mm-hmm. They say, it can't be more powerful than I am because it is me and that whole internal shift. And I think that gets missed.
This is one that I actually have seen a few times. I think it's pretty common. How do I forgive myself for the time I've lost to my eating disorder?
Yeah, you know, I don't think you need to because here's what I think. I think that people will eventually realize that all of the lessons that you learn in recovery, you can apply to your life. Mm-hmm. I feel like I was so much more prepared to deal even with body image stuff as my friends got older, because I went through it in a such an intense way, you know? Yeah. It doesn't mean I don't have those issues and wish I wasn't, you know, looking more like my mom than my sister, you know? You have them living in this culture, and I don't expect people to be like this perfectionism. That why would I do that? So it's the lessons we learn. I think anorexia was my best teacher, And I learned about my traits. I learned about how to use my anxiety as energy. I learned how to use my perfectionism as great drive and tenacity. I learned from that experience. Mm. And like I said earlier, I learned that something that I absolutely would have sworn to you I could not do, I could do. Imagine remembering to apply that to things now. When you don't have to forgive yourself for losing time. It won't really be lost. If you look back through, you will sift it for its gold and you will find it.
I think that's such a beautiful way to think about it. I hadn't thought about it like that, the reason that you don't need to forgive yourself might just be waiting to show up, because I can see so many of those experiences where friends are, you know, dealing with something that I had to face in my 20s, or, you know, reality that I had to work through, or skills that I had to adopt, or like an armor that I was able to put around myself that I can now see my friends are struggling with or questioning or, you know, not quite sure how to cope with. And I felt so out of sync with them in my 20s because I was so out of my life in my eating disorder and then in my recovery. And now it's not just the, and you don't have to go into the field or be working in this space to also utilize your experience with something really positive for other people as well. I put something up on my Instagram recently saying, like, you don't have to go into the field or even spread awareness for your recovery to be really powerful. Just the example that you can be amongst your peers and with your kids, your family members can be so powerful, whether it's the body image stuff and being able to be more accepting or compassionate with your body or demonstrating a relationship with food that no one else around the table might, you know, they might not be able to demonstrate that because they've never had to face it. The opportunities for what this could mean and what it could represent, you're just not going to know until it shows up. There's so many things that happen even now where I'm like, oh God, I'm so glad I did that work 10 years ago. So grateful.
I'd say just know that it's going to be your teacher. If it doesn't feel like that now, and it probably, you probably could find out things right now if you looked hard enough where it's already been teaching you, but you will. And if anyone doubts that, as you go along in your trajectory or your journey or whatever, if you get down the road and you don't think you've learned anything, send me an email. I want to know about that.
Yeah. That's part of what I love about coaching is being able to help people bring all those pieces together along the way, being able to help them have pit stops where we reflect on what have we learned, what have we achieved, how have we changed, how have we evolved, what can we be proud of? Because I think people have this, and it's not a surprise given a lot of people come from like that black and white perfectionistic thinking where they're like, I'm in recovery and then I'm recovered. It's all hard. And then I get all the lessons and like the label and it's all wonderful. And it's like, well, there's still life on the other side of that, by the way, as many of us find out the hard
way. Oh shit, now what thing?
Yeah. Totally. But there's actually pit stops where there's stages of freedom, there's stages of joy, there's stages of these increased things that you get access to. And if you just, I often say, it's kind of like, I mean, I wish I could come up sometimes with metaphors that weren't so movement-based, but they work. Like if you're doing a hike and you spend the whole time looking at your shoes, you're going to lose total perspective of where you are and how far you've come and how you did it and how you traversed this bit. Sometimes you need to sit on that park bench and like have a protein bar and have a look around and look at the map and go, oh, wow, look at how far I've come and how I did that. Oh, and I don't actually have that much further to go to the next pit stop. Fantastic. Well, now I've got more perspective. That feels more doable. Whereas if like you've just got your head down looking at all the hard and the terrible and the difficult, you're missing out on some really clarifying moments, I think.
Yeah. There's your feet and then there's the summit.
Yeah.
And you miss everything in between.
Yes, exactly. It's not one or the other. We can do a bit of both. So is there specific advice for recovery during menopause, which differs from being younger?
Certainly, I think there's age-appropriate things that happen and issues that women who are older deal with who might be have kids or they've been married already, or I don't know if the person is referring to the body changing or what exactly, but I would say if you go along in this trajectory with people, there are unique things about every space, whether it's adolescent growth spurt, mm-hmm. whether it's going off to college the first time, you know, whether it's the first time, you know, being involved sexually, romantically with somebody. And so what I would say about that is I don't have anything particular in terms of just to say about menopause, but I will go back to something I said earlier about make sure that the person you're seeing isn't putting you in a box and that you have individualized treatment. Mm-hmm. And it's important to you to bring how you think that part of your life is fitting into and playing into and sort of perpetuating the eating disorder, because the reason that the eating disorder started is not always the reason that perpetuated. So sometimes people will be working on the reasons that it started and they resolve a lot of issues or underlying things that happened to them, maybe when in childhood or some trauma or something, but there may be reasons. So ask yourself and work yourself with your practitioners on how do you think it's affecting you and how would you look at it? And I'm going to go back to my fave, which is what would you tell a friend who was having those issues with menopause and struggling with an eating disorder? Because probably what you would tell them is what you need to be telling yourself.
Beautiful. I think that's such a great point that just like your reasons to recover might evolve, the reasons why your eating disorder is sticking around has probably evolved as well. And especially if it's been around through different iterations of your life, even if part of it, like the amount of people who I speak to, where like part of it is that it's become habitual. It's just what they do when these certain emotions or events happen. That's just their default. So I think that, you know, just focusing on that initial why or, you know, kickoff point is important, but it may actually not be as relevant as the most recent reason why it's claiming it needs to help you.
I think we should start a radio station. Call in.
Yes, yes. I love it. We can be like agony aunts for eating disorders. Love it. We'll get in touch with SiriusXM. I think that's the only American radio station I know.
That's okay. I'll go Australian.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Okay. Yeah, we can do this from our time zones. This one I really like. Thoughts on the absence of industry regulation for coaches. Love the idea of this role, but have concerns re potential for harm. I'm sure you have thoughts.
Yeah, I'm speaking about it. I'm writing about it. Mm-hmm. I've become a member of the International Organization of Coaching here out of Harvard in America. I think every single thing, like when someone became a therapist, you know, way back when, who was regulating therapists? Yeah. What body was regulating them? When the first hospital program started, who was regulating that? You know, when the first treatment programs like CBT started somewhere, it wasn't an evidence-based treatment until somebody started it and gathered data. So I think I'll say this, there is a research study that's about to take place, which is a collaboration between Australia and America, and it's about coaching, and we'll see what happens. And it's pretty rigorous because there are really hardcore researchers on this panel. And I don't know how that's going to be, because I think it's a hard thing to research, because how do you have a control group, you know? But I think what I'm saying is there has to be the person who does the training needs to be a clinician, and it has to be a clinically backed program. So it's not just someone who's recovered. I don't think that works. There has to be forms of exams and interactive stuff like videos and books and readings in the field, and then exams. There has to be an internship with supervision. And then there has to be not only a certification, but ongoing continued education. Those are the main things that I tell people to look for. And I already know of some places that have opened up and are training coaches that are not doing all those things.
Yeah.
I think that's sad, because I feel like, you know, it can, you know, one bad apple and people can start to say, see, coaching doesn't work.
Yeah.
But it's like anything. There are therapists out there, doctors out there, dentists out there, gymnastic coaches out there who are going to do bad things or be misinformed and not be the best in the field. And the best we can do is work to, and I'm trying to come up with these standards and try to talk about them at every talk I go to. And I think it will evolve there. I think it will.
I think so too. And I think, you know, any coach or any program that wouldn't be absolutely pushing for regulation and oversight, et cetera, run a mile, because we want to be, not only because it's an ethical thing that I think would benefit the whole industry, but also because it gets us closer towards things like being able to have sessions subsidized on Medicare and able to be more plugged into the professional community. There's so many benefits both for the professional and for the client. And, you know, I have been on a review panel for work that Butterfly is doing, trying to push that along. So there's definitely steps in place and we are all for it. But you're so right. These things have to start somewhere. And this was such a missing piece of the treatment approach, and particularly outpatient, and being able to really keep people tethered to their recovery and hope, and again, long-term, keeping them out of environments which are more like hospital or inpatient or residential. And, you know, full kudos to you that in the meantime, there is rigorous supervision. We are required to recertify every 2 years. There is a constant loop back to CCI. There are so many avenues of connection, whether or not it's within the coaching community or it's supervision that you provide to the coaches in group settings, et cetera. I mean, you could not be more hands-on with this thing. I don't think people quite understand the extent to which you are.
And you know
involved.
What else they also don't know is that I don't take a salary, and that all the money goes back into eating disorder philanthropy.
I know. I wish. I'm like, I want you to get that stamped on your forehead.
I know. I feel like it sometimes, but I do think it's tricky. And as you know, I try really hard to get on it if I have some kind of complaint or whatever. And I try to have the coaches stay in their lane, you know, and there's a big dividing line about not dealing with underlying issues, not doing treatment, not doing trauma work, not diagnosing, referring things back to the team, communicating with the team. But all that's a little bit hard. Sometimes you have team members who, you know, I just got something today from a coach, you know, I've sent of the releases and I haven't heard back. And then another coach just told me, I heard back and the therapist said, I don't have time to communicate. You just do your thing and I'll do mine.
Yeah, heard that one. And if it all goes terribly, guess who's going to be lumped with it? Even in this, you know, gathering of questions, I had people, you know, tethering onto the end of their questions. I've been working with this coach or this coach and their CCI coaches and saying like, thank you so much, Carolyn, for, you know, being able to make this person available to me. They've changed my life and saved my life. So there is so much good out there, but again, a bit perfectionistic to think that, you know, there's not going to be gray areas here. And this is one of them. We're moving towards more regulation and we're all
I'm always happy to hear good things like that, because as you know, I'm the one who hears if there's one small thing that goes bad. So
I know there is a ton of good. There is so much good. Carolyn, thank you so much for today. I loved this. I loved having some, you know, new fresh things for me to ask you. I'm so grateful to my audience for being able to send these over. I hope we'll get to do this again, because I think that this was a really interesting, chat with a bit of a different approach.
Oh my gosh, I would definitely do it again. So I don't have to do any preparing. I just sit here and come off the top of my head. So
that's it. That's the beauty of it. I love doing these with you. Thank you so much.